Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we convene the Science Forum, as we do every month or so. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments on Facebook, sure, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or tweet us at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email voxpop@WAMC.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. We had a scintillating discussion about stereo gear as we waited for the show to start, but now we'll talk about real science and what fun we have. Let's meet our panel of experts.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm a retired organic chemist.
Jim, you look very relaxed.
I am.
Good. Nice to have you here. Who are you?
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, not retired, but shortly to be on sabbatical.
Oh, good for you. Are you going to do anything special on sabbatical?
Sleep a lot.
Oh, really?
That's not what it says officially on his request.
Yeah, I'm going to be working for quite a while up north, looking at ice, actually.
Really?
Yep, studying ice.
In what capacity?
In capacity of an ice scientist?
What are you going to look at? We've all seen ice. I have some in my freezer.
We're going to look at the formation of ice within the water column going from Montreal to Halifax, Nova Scotia. So we're going to take the boat and just keep on going back and forth looking at ice formation depending on temperature and salinity.
So at the end, you'll be like Jack Nicholson in the Shining.
I'll be...
He's already starting now.
It's the beard. It gives it away.
And who's the funny lady over there?
The one not on sabbatical or retired. I'm Barbara Brabets, biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill, scheduled for lots of classes this spring.
Well, nice to have you all here. And we were talking after the scintillating discussion about stereos from the 1970s and earlier. We talked a little bit about the ban of microbeads.
Yes. President Obama has just signed this legislation into effect. I'm not exactly sure when it will go into effect, but it should be shortly. And this has been a grassroots groundswell of environmental outrage over these little buggers, these little plastic beads that are found in your toothpaste and your facial scrubs and your kitchen cleansers. And the problem with them is that they don't biodegrade. They just get through the water column, out through the wastewater and into the waterways and get stuck in the gills of fish and small filter feeders, or concentrate in the water, even if they don't end up in the fish. And then they have an affinity for organic molecules that Jim can talk about. And so they concentrate in very small areas, large amounts of toxin.
Yep.
He's nodding on radio.
Oh, yes, I'm nodding
okay.
on the radio.
Somebody might be watching on our video stream.
I didn't know that it was my turn. Because there's sort of the rule that like dissolves like. So these little plastic beads are a lot like the small organic molecules that might be floating around, some of them having some toxicity, and they will just dissolve into the plastic bead.
It seems to me that it wouldn't be that difficult to make something that you could use as an exfoliant that would biodegrade.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all about the bottom line and money. So they've been using effectively commodities, cheap plastic. They could use a biodegradable plastic or a water-soluble plastic that degrades within, say, a month.
Right. Or volcanic ash, for that matter. There's an awful lot of that around.
Yeah.
In fact, the scrubs used to have plant pit, and they use that as a medium for exfoliation. But people have allergies to certain plants, and, you know, apricot pits, what are you going to do? They don't sound as sexy as microbead. But I think they're going to be making a comeback.
All right. Let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Started off with Mary in Millbrook. Mary, you're on.
Okay. I have a question about the dishwasher.
Ah.
When the dishwasher finishes, the dishes at the top of the dishwasher, the china or glasses are always dry, but the plastic things that you put in the top are not dry. They're still wet. They have beads of water on them. Why?
Well, that's a good question.
That's a terrific question, and yeah, I think it's a first on Science Forum to get this question.
But probably not the last.
We're not discontinued in the new year.
Yeah, but it's unlikely you're going to get a good answer, I think, from that very good question. That's a real puzzle, because they should reach the same temperature.
But then is there a thermal conduct? Yeah, how long are the bake cycles now, the heating cycles on the dishwashers? If they're not as long as they used to be.
It doesn't matter. The china and the crystal is still dry, but the plastic isn't. It still has all the beads of water on it.
It Okay, I'll speculate.
Okay, good. We like that on the show. Yes.
On plastic, the water will bead up. So
right.
You'll have a big globs of water on.
Again, because like dissolves like, yeah. And unlike does not dissolve.
Yes.
And there's also a case of a surface tension between the water and the plastic, which is different than the other materials.
That's right. And then on the glass and on china, the water droplets will spread out more.
Right.
So there'll be a larger surface area exposed on the glass and on the china, and the water can evaporate away faster.
Right. So if you have a thin layer of water, water will evaporate at the same temperature faster than if you have a glob of water where it's only evaporating from the very surface of that glob.
Now, the trick with all of that is the reason that you get globs of water is because either the water is a bit hard or it's because the detergent's not working well enough to make the water have a lower surface tension so it spreads out.
So, Mary, do you know if you have hard water?
Yeah, but it happens. It happens in Saugerties, and it happens in Round Top, and it happens here. You know, it happens in different places. But when you were talking, I began to think of one thing: the crystal in the china reaches a higher temperature than the plastic.
No, I see some head shaking here.
No? It's all going to be, if the heat cycle is long enough, everything will reach the same temperature inside. It'll be in equilibrium thermally.
Even the plastic.
Well, the plastic will cool off faster.
Yeah.
So that's why when you open it up after leaving it for a while, the plastic feels cooler than the rest.
Well, it's also a matter that they'll be cooler to the touch because it transfers heat more slowly to your fingers.
Right.
Uh-huh. So even if they're exactly the same temperature, the plastic will not feel as hot as china or glass.
So you think it's because of the surface, water.
Do you use a rinse aid?
No, I use the one that that includes the rinse aid in it. You know, cascade or top grade finish.
Yeah, if there's a container for a rinse aid in the dishwasher, using that might help.
Well, let me ask you this.
Because it will tend to flatten out those drops.
Right.
Do you get drops on your glasses? Do you
spots.
Get
no.
spots on your glasses?
No.
Okay, so that's probably not the problem either. My guess is that it's just the way that the surface tension of the water on the plastic remains.
Huh.
In fact, there's two things I would suggest. First, I would consider opening it up just after the dry cycle and see if there's a change. The second thing I would suggest, if I can remember what I was just thinking, what was I thinking?
Thinking about ice and Canada.
I don't know, but I'm still stuck on power saver mode. Could it possibly be that you're using a shortened drying cycle?
So, and what about heat dry? Some people don't use that.
Right.
IntelliClean and temperature sensors off. And heated dry is on.
Okay. Interesting.
Can you do an experiment for us, Mary, and then call in next time? Can you run the same dishes with the heated dry and then with the power dry, the power save dry, and see if the problem gets worse or better on the plastic? Because that will allow us to figure out if it's Ed's answer or if it's Jim's answer.
There's another possibility too, and that's that if you leave it in there long enough, the humidity level in a dishwasher could be quite high.
Interesting.
And it's quite possible that the drops are forming after the cycle's over.
I think
so check it immediately?
Right.
Immediately, I know it's off because I've emptied the dishwasher. Now, you know what? My husband empties it in the morning, and I don't know if they're there in the morning. I don't know. Where is he?
Not sure where he is.
Hey,
Stan,
different materials could be hygroscopic.
Is the water on the plastic in the morning in the top of the dishwasher? On the droplets on the plastic containers in the morning when you empty the dishwasher? Yes, he said it is.
All right. Is he just sort of playing along, Mary?
No, he said the plastic measuring cup is wet.
But the thing about that, now we come up with Barb's piece to this.
Okay.
And that is, sometimes the plastic cups or the plastic bowls have a concave bottom, which means they have a deeper pool of water.
On the top.
Well, upside down, it would be on the top, yes.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen with glass. Usually you don't have a glass with a concave bottom unless you have a very expensive whiskey glass,
yes.
Right, Ray?
I've got a few.
Yeah. But
they
don't go in the dishwasher.
Sure they do.
Okay.
No?
I don't know. Some don't.
Why?
Because they're too delicate.
All right, we need to talk about why you can't wash whiskey glasses in the dishwasher. This is our next... Hey, Mary, we got to take a break here, but thank you.
Yeah, I think people are probably getting bored with this question.
Oh,
no,
we're going
to do it.
We love the question. Zach the engineer is...
Sorry.
Yeah, he's nodding. Mary, thanks a lot for the call, and have a happy new year, and...
This is a way for our spouses to convince us to do the dishwasher. I can tell.
I love this. This is a great way to start the show.
I think we've become car talk, though.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Yeah, not bad. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Fort Hill Auto Body, Amherst, Massachusetts. Locally owned and operated since 1997, providing auto body repair, detailing, painting, and glass replacement, a proud supporter of public radio, FortHillAutoBody.com. The Lily and the Rose, a farm-to-table catering company specializing in destination wedding and special events in New York State and beyond, with wild edibles, vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free menus, LilyandTheRose.com. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. And Hudson Wine Merchants, a wine and spirits boutique in the heart of Hudson, New York, offering selections for holiday meals, gifts, and everyday wines. Curbside service and delivery available. Raise your glass, HudsonWines.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC, the last one for 2015. The number to call is 800-348-2551. And if we keep answering dishwasher questions, it could be the last one ever.
No.
No, I thought that was fun, though.
It was?
It was fun.
And
that's right. Get your questions in before the end of 2015. Next year, the questions will be different.
That's right.
And right, there'll be an increase in the premium.
Well, the dishwasher question I found fascinating because I've noticed this as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have plastic, but the thing is, when we do plastic cups or whatever for the kids, or plastic bowls, always on the top. I wonder if we didn't ask Mary where she puts
them on the top.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
Right.
So that could be an issue too, right?
Well, that's where the condensation is going to start from.
Well, I'm going to spend the next couple of days doing this.
Really?
Your wife will be very happy.
Yeah. All right,
I like the water pooling.
The pooling is a real issue. Yeah, you can look at the bottoms of the things that have the water. If it's droplets on the side, that's one thing. But if it's like a substantial teaspoon or so of water on the top of the bottom of a cup, then I think it's the pooling issue.
What about on the metal utensils? We didn't check that either.
They're on the bottom usually.
I don't use plastic in the dish, plastic utensils.
But I'm saying, did she have any condensation or water left on, let's say, spoons? You know?
So many variables.
Enough about dishwashers. Let's go to line one. James in Highland, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. How are you? And ladies.
Thanks.
I have a question. You have an electric car, and
I
you
do.
Plug it in at night to recharge the battery, okay? How come you can't put, like, generators on the wheels? So when the car is driving, you're harnessing that energy from the wheels turning to power the generators to replenish the battery as you drive.
This is the best science forum I have ever been on.
Yeah, it's called the
perpetual motion.
The first law of thermodynamics. That is, you can't create energy. So if you're using energy to make the car go, you also have to overcome friction and air resistance. If you had a generator to try to generate electricity to recharge the battery, your car would simply stop.
But you could supplement it. I mean, weren't the old generators in cars, didn't they do just that?
Well, the problem is that if you have a generator on, the generator takes energy to run. And so what you're doing is taking energy out of the wheels, keeping them from turning, to power the generator. And that's then powering the battery. So all you're doing is making a loop, effectively.
All right, James, thank you. But, you know, the reason I ask is... I had an old 65 Le Mans for years when I was a kid, and it didn't have an alternator. It had a generator, and I thought it performed, to some extent, that function of keeping the battery charged.
Oh, it might.
Well, yeah.
even at a decrease of efficiency of running the car itself.
Yeah, so you're paying for that in burning gas.
Yeah,
right.
The first law of thermodynamics basically is you can't get something for nothing.
Right.
And so
what you try to do is minimize your losses. Yeah. So even in hybrid vehicles that have the kind of braking recharge idea, that it only institutes it when it's not a problem, when you're trying to get rid of energy. So you apply the brake and then you grab that energy from the brake and then help recharge just a little bit those batteries.
Right.
Yeah. And that's energy that otherwise would have simply gone to heat.
Right.
So the energy has to go somewhere, and in a hybrid, it goes into a battery.
So heat. Maybe you should have a steam generator.
How are you going to make the steam?
From the heat.
Oh, from the heat.
From the heat.
But then every time you transfer energy in a system, you lose a little bit.
Yeah.
So if you can take it directly from heat to electricity, then that's more efficient than heat to mechanical pressure to electricity.
Now, baking a ham in the engine compartment of a vehicle,
that's something.
That's good. That's good.
You should have a Friday show about that.
Yes, you can get lunch.
Yeah.
Food Friday with cars.
Cooking in the, basically, it works better if you have an 18-wheeler. You put a nice turkey in there.
Have you ever had a copy of the book? There's a whole book of how to cook things on your engine.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Do
you use PAM instead of motor oil?
No, I think aluminum foil plays a large role in this.
It does for most things. Greenwald in Red Hook, you're on.
Hello. Could you tell me why isn't everything upside down in Antarctica?
All right, turn your radio down just a little bit before we get this very important answer.
Well, first off, we're not flat, so we're a circle. So we're all kind of stuck to our orb.
Okay.
So we're drawn to the gravity at the center of the planet, and that's relatively equidistant, no matter where we are on the surface. Of course, we're a little wider at the equator than we are at the poles.
Oh, isn't that
we're
the
a little
truth?
Squashy.
Yes.
Yeah. Pear-shaped.
Yes.
But that means that gravity is really what's holding us. Our up and down is all relative.
Yeah, of course. If we're sitting on the moon and you looked over at the Earth, people in Antarctica are upside down. But they're being pulled towards the center of gravity.
Yeah. And we're standing at a 45-degree angle.
That's right.
That's a good point.
Or about that, yes.
Greenwald, thanks a lot for that. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Before we get to David in Cambridge on the pressing dishwasher question, take a couple of emails that came in on the pressing dishwasher question. Dan says, it may be that the thickness and composition of the china and glassware is such that it retains heat longer, therefore drying more thoroughly. And I think
you guys talked about that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jamie. Something for everyone. How far are we from organic gel packs to replace electronic components used today? That's nothing to do with dishwashers. Anybody?
Organic gel packs
I don't know
to
what
replace
they are.
Electronics?
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
I don't know that either.
Maybe to replace batteries, but that's about it.
Is biology the answer to making smaller and smaller layers for microprocessors?
Possibly. That's been done in a lab as a proof of concept, where you can have bacteria layer a very thin film based on what they eat and what they deposit. We'll call it deposits.
But something as large as a bacterium or even a virus is giant.
It's giant
compared to the size that's on the microelectronic devices.
Mm-hmm. Right. We can do one molecule thick mechanically or with engineering, and a bacteria is not going to deposit one molecule thick.
Yeah. All right. And here's another one. Jamie's all over the map. Do we have a supercomputer in Antarctica because of the cold?
The colder things are, the better the chips run, yes.
Okay. So do we have them there?
I don't know.
Not yet.
And my goal is to get to Antarctica. I will take that one as homework.
Okay. And watch the ice while you're there.
Okay.
This is also from Jamie. The dishwasher issue has two components. First, many of the new dishwashers do not vent any longer.
Correct.
And you have to pop the door at the end to stop that. Also, put your plastic containers on the side when washing so moisture does not condense under the container. Okay. Let's go to, let's just try to answer a few more dishwasher questions and go to David in Cambridge. David, you're on.
I'm afraid I've been rendered redundant by the fellow. Was it Jamie who was emailing?
Yeah.
But, basically, this is the part. I mean, it comes to physics, of course. I'm a punk band drummer. That would be a great segment to the show, Ask a punk band
drummer. Ask a punk band
drummer.
Your
physics questions.
The answer's always in 4-4, isn't it?
We'll go from the sublime to the absurd.
Yes, we do that a lot on the Science Forum.
But the part about the, I remember that, there's a couple of shows that just kind of go out of control.
Yeah, you think?
But it's just a matter of mass, I would imagine. The China, after this might go down to a cool down cycle, or once it stops heating, the China being more massive than the plastic per se, or the polymers, it would retain the heat long enough to cause whatever puddles of water in the concave to evaporate.
It's possible. Yeah, we did mention that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's hence my redundancy as to this matter. There's another possibility. So since I might as well just skip off to the absurd, is the way she might be observing the experiment might have a certain Heisenberg effect.
Ah, yes. Now we're into the quantum.
Let the cat out of the dishwasher.
Don't buy a quantum dishwasher. That's the
is the dish alive or dead?
Yeah. That's your takeaway.
Well, David, thank you for that, taking us into another realm, and we will move on. 800-348-2551. Elaine in Niskayuna. Hello, Elaine.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
How are you? Thank you. I picked up a funny little shell coral combination at the beach, and I'm just wondering, did the shell fuse itself to the coral, or did the coral go after the shell? I have these, it's a pink shell, like a little clam shell, and it has these rays of clam shell that kind of go down into the coral.
Hmm.
And then also the coral seems to kind of have grown into the shell. So I just, chicken and egg kind of question.
Well, coral grows on any substrate it can get a hold of. So effectively, more than likely, the shell was down there on the bottom, and the coral grew on it.
Now, how big are the little shells?
Well, it's just one shell, and it's probably about 3 inches across.
Yeah. Okay,
it's
so
bottom,
it's an adult
shell.
Yeah. So the only really mobile phase of most mollusks is the larval stage. They actually are pretty mobile, mm-hmm. and they can transport in the water column, but the adult filter feeders pretty much stay placed. They can move around like in a small area, but they're not big movers up or down because they want the bottom. They want to get the stuff that's filtering down. So most likely it fell onto the coral and then the coral engulfed it because the coral's an animal.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know that. But it just looks like the orange of the shell is really in rays going right down as if when the coral is sucking it. Is that it? It's sucking
It generally speaking just sticks to it. There are mollusks, they're called productids, which actually have points sticking out of them, which look like coral. So it's possible that if it's the same sort of material, it might actually be a productid clam or something like that, which looks like coral, but it actually isn't. You'd have to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the part of the coral that you see when it washes up on shore is the bony part of the coral. There's more of the animal that is that. It's their structure. It's their bone structure, basically. So they need to spread out. And if they're going to grow, they have to create this bone structure in order to grow. So they tend to grow upward and outward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Elaine,
thank you.
Thanks a lot. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Bye now. Oh, and over to Roxanne in Scotia. Roxanne.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was out on the evening of the 25th to see the full moon, and it's the first time I've ever seen this. There was an incredibly huge corona around the full moon, and I could see a spectrum of rainbow colors around it. I could see oranges, greens, and blues. But then there was a second corona, and instead of it being concentric with the moon in the center, it shot off the edge of the first large corona. And so I guess I have a two-part question. What causes the corona around the moon? And the second question is, what would cause that second corona not to be exactly concentric around the first, and not even like the moon even on the perimeter of the circle that it caused?
Okay.
If you go on to spaceweather.com, you can actually see there's a dozen different ways in which they can form depending on what the ice crystals are like and what their form is in the atmosphere.
But to start with, it's ice crystals.
It's ice crystals in very, very high cirrus clouds that cause the corona effect in the first place. It also causes glories, for example. It causes anytime you're looking through a cloud
too.
Or sun dogs, all these things. And some of the, you can get one corona around the moon, you can get a second one. Concentric to it, you can get small rings north and south of the moon, up above and below the moon, which are along one of the glories that are already there. So you can get any number of variations. Some of them are more rare than others.
Did the full moon contribute to how bright these coronas were, that she could see them better?
Yeah, the brighter it is, the more light passes through the crystals, and therefore the brighter the coronas as well. But definitely take a look at that on spaceweather.com, and you'll see pictures of it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sounds like a wonderful sight, and it was just such a beautiful thing to see, and I'm glad I have a dog that I have to walk late at night.
Oh, well, thanks for the call. Happy New Year.
Yeah, sometimes
Thank
they're
you
called
so
moon
much.
Dogs, by the way,
yeah.
So you could have had a couple dogs out there.
Mm. Moon dogs. Good. So, I mean, when I grew up around here, and we saw this quite often. When I was a kid, if you saw that, you had a shot that there will be a snow day the next day.
That's right.
Yep.
Because cirrus clouds are a harbinger of what's to come.
Mm-hmm. All right. And let's go to Brian in Melbrook. Brian, you're on.
Oh, hey. So I'm actually a material scientist who works with polymers and ceramics.
Cool.
And I had to call in. Really quickly, there's something called heat capacity, which is how effectively a material can store heat.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it's actually the mass. So the fact that the ceramic has a higher mass, it stores more thermal energy. So it stays hot longer, and that helps dry it more effectively.
Huh.
Then that would require that the humidity in the dishwasher dissipate relatively quickly.
Potentially, but the fact of the matter is the heat's being transitioned from the mug, let's just say, to the water on the surface. So if there's heat being consistently applied to the water on the surface, because it's stored more energy,
mm-hmm.
Even if it's humidity in the air. As the humidity dies off, that heat's still going to be there trying to drive it.
But that still requires everything to get to the same temperature.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, Brian, thanks a lot for calling in.
I guess I won't have to do the dishwasher anymore.
Yep. Happy New Year. Over to Chris in Albany. Chris.
How you doing? I have a quick question, but I also want to make a shout-out to Dr. Bravitz because she was my chemistry teacher.
All right.
Oh, hey, Chris.
How's it going?
Good.
So I
was
have
he
a
good student?
I don't know which Chris it is. Is it Chris T?
It was back in 2005, so it was a while ago.
Did I just see your brother the other day?
Nope, not my brother.
Okay, so this is the other one. This is the good one.
This is the bad Chris.
Okay, all right.
Only kidding, Chris.
So,
go ahead.
You know, we use batteries to store energy, and we always have issues with excess energy going to waste. My question for you guys is, why don't we use compressed gas to store extra energy with, like, solar and wind?
Actually, it's done in Europe. Quite significantly. What they do is they use excess energy from the grid to compress gas off-site in relatively rural areas. Then they transport the compressed gas and use compressed gas vehicles in the city centers in order to keep the smog down in the centers.
Yeah, and I think there are proposals to do kind of low-pressure pressurized gas in caves and such. One of the problems is that there is a loss of efficiency in that in compressing the gas, it gives off heat.
Right. Anytime, you know, PV equals NRT, Chris, right?
Yep. So yeah, well, this is the Joule Thompson.
That's right.
Anyway, so you compress it and it gives off heat. So that's energy that's lost. When the gas expands again, it has to take energy from somewhere, probably the air, or be supplied to expand again.
Yeah.
So you have inherent losses with that.
So we could use refrigerators to do this.
Well, yeah. But again, it's the no free lunch law of thermodynamics. So it's not a bad idea. It's seriously contemplated, and it's probably as good as other storage ideas.
Right, and it's and it is used whenever there's excess energy on the grid in Europe. So,
Chris, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Have a great New Year.
You too. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Newburgh. Jim.
Hi. Let's see. This is an 8th grade girl question that I've never had a satisfactory answer for, been able to find a satisfactory answer.
All right.
If you have two bodies in space, okay, and they each have gravity, and things fall towards those objects at a given rate, you know, acceleration due to gravity. As those two things come together, do the gravities add up?
Yes.
It does?
Yep.
Okay. That's good enough.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye now.
Good luck. Didn't sound like an eighth grade girl.
That's how planets are made.
Yeah.
You start off with something small, it gets larger and larger and larger. It's a snowball effect.
Mm. All right. Let's go over to, let's see now, I think we've already answered Chris on line 5, so let's go over to Christine in Mount Tremper. Christine.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right, this is a simple, I hope, food question.
All right.
I just made latkes with my friends.
Yum. Mm.
Yum, and they were great, but my friend dipped the applesauce spoon into the sour cream spoon container, and I said, no, you can't do that. You're going to grow bacteria if we don't get all the applesauce out.
Oh, boy.
Will that happen?
Well, it depends on your sour cream.
Sounds delicious.
But the problem really with sour cream and applesauce is that there's a little bit of vinegar in the sour cream, and it can denature any other protein that it encounters. So if you mix sour cream and lemons, for example, you make lemon curd in a way.
Mm, delicious.
Right, but will it affect my sour cream? Can I use it again without worrying that it's going to grow bacteria quicker because he dipped the applesauce spoon in it?
No, if anything, the one that has more bacteria would be your sour cream, not necessarily your applesauce.
No worries then.
No worries.
Well, you know,
you
may have a change in taste, though, if there was significant denaturation, the curdling of either the applesauce or the sour cream. Which way did it go? Applesauce to sour cream?
Oh, we lost her.
Oh, that's okay.
You know what? I love this show. What a strange mix we have. From dishwashers to latkes, it's lovely. 800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York. Specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. Holiday gift sets in stock now. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. And Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York. An open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat, holiday services, their religious school, cultural programs, and more, saratogasinai.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum, and what an eclectic show we've had thus far. How could it get any better? 800-348-2551. Let's find out. Pat in Pittsfield, you're next. Pat.
Hi. I've been listening to this show for years and always enjoyed it.
Thank you.
But now I've got a chance for a good question, I think.
Okay.
When I heard you had an ice observer on the panel.
Yes, we do.
I have wondered for years. Usually when I put an ice cube tray in the freezer and I take it out, there's a spike of ice growing out of the center of some of the cubes,
yes.
Like a stalagmite. And I have no idea how that happens. I wondered if they could tell me.
Oh, I bet we have people who will answer that question.
I can answer that. Can I take that question?
Ice spikes for 10, Alex.
It's easy. What happens is when water freezes, it expands. And when you have an ice cube holder, then there's no place for it to expand except towards the center. So you grow the ice on the outside first, and in the center of the ice is a little bit of water. And you can actually see that if you put ice cubes in there and let them start cooling. You'll see that because thermal conductivity, you've got metal on the outside or plastic, it freezes from the outside in. And when you get towards the center, you've got that little bit of water, and if the pressure builds up high enough and you have a little crack, it starts shooting out the top because it's the only way it can go. And so you get spikes. You get the same thing actually happening in caves. They're called helictites. You can get in all different environments. But basically, you get a pressure forming inside the center because the ice is forming. And as a result, the water's got to go somewhere because it's pretty well incompressible. So it comes out the top.
So if you had a freezer that would freeze it faster, would you have a bigger spike or a smaller spike?
Generally speaking, if it's faster, then you get too much ice forming on the top, and then you don't get the spike at all. It's got to be just the right temperature. Probably if your fridge is, your freezer is probably a little bit too low for what it should be.
The temperature
be.
Is set too low?
Right, just slightly too low. So what happens is it freezes more on the side than the top breaks, and the spike forms.
Interesting.
See, I would have expected it to rise, but I was puzzled by the fact that it rose in a very thin spike in the middle. And
well,
thank you for explaining that.
The center of that spike, believe it or not, is not frozen. The water is being forced out, and it's freezing on the outside of the spike, and the center is actually a little tube that's bringing water from below to the top. So it forms higher and higher as it forms.
Jim?
Yep. And there, I recently saw a YouTube video that I think is either on the Vsauce or Veritasium site, but surely if you do a search on ice spikes, you'll find this YouTube video that shows this marvelously.
Wow.
And just as Ed said, that was the mechanism.
Pat, great question. Thank you.
I appreciate your time, folks.
Happy New Year. Over to James in Highland. James.
Yes, my question is, how you doing again?
you've been on before.
Yeah.
Oh, you're violating a cardinal rule, but I'm going to let it slide because we're in a good mood today.
Happy New Year, James.
You guys are great. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
I will take that as a gift.
Okay.
All right. My question is, if microwave can heat water more rapidly, how come no one's ever invented a microwave boiler to heat your home? A microwave furnace?
Well, there again, it's a matter of, you're not getting something for nothing. The microwaves heat up water quickly, but you're using the electricity to generate those microwaves. You could use that. You would heat the water just as efficiently, maybe more efficiently, using a heating element, an electric hot water heater. So the microwaves do it quickly when you're cooking, but I don't think it's particularly efficient.
Well, a typical microwave is 1,200 watts.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the same thing as a heating element in a
blow
furnace.
Dryer.
So it's about the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really, so but doesn't the heating element run longer than the microwave, hence, you know, saving something?
1,000 watts is 1,000 watts. So the amount of heat that's produced is effectively the same in either case.
And we usually don't heat our food to boiling. We usually heat our food to hot. So we can put, you know, you can put your teacup in there and get it to boil, but it takes longer than a couple minutes.
Yeah.
And there actually is a problem, too. Have you ever put a teacup of water in a microwave?
Oh, yeah.
And then brought it out and have it explode on you?
Right.
No.
The superheating.
You superheat it, and that can cause air bubbles suddenly to form, and the air bubbles explode effectively, and the stuff piles out.
So this might be a safety hazard if you made a furnace out of this.
The bumping could happen with the boiling could be significant. Yep.
James, thanks a lot. Very interesting call. A lot of fascinating and diverse calls today. And I suspect we'll get another one right now. Madeline in Rhinebeck, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to know if it actually makes a difference in flavor if you add salt during the cooking process or if you add it after everything is cooked and you just add it to taste.
Yeah, it does. If you think of, here's eighth grade science all over again, osmosis. Osmosis is the movement of water from inside a cell to outside a cell or from outside a cell into the cell, depending on the concentration gradient. So when you add salt to the outside of a cell, you've effectively lowered the concentration of water and increased the concentration of salt. So it dries out your cells. So when you sweat onions in a frying pan and you add salt to it, you make them sweat a little faster because you're drawing the moisture from outside the cell, the individual cells of the onion. So if you add the salt, it's actually part of the process of cooking. It's not just for flavoring. You're going to get a different product if you add the salt at the end. You might still taste the same saltiness, but the processes that have gone on in your organic matter, your plants and your animals, is going to be different.
And the best example of that is making taking bones, for example, and making a broth. Mm. And if you make a broth without salt in the water,
you're not going to get all the
goodness. You don't get all the flavor because the flavor comes out of the bones because of the salt.
Because we're coming from inside the cells to the outside the cells.
Right. So making a soup, you always add salt at the beginning. Other things you'd add it at the end to keep the flavor within this in it. Oh, we know everything.
You know what? Note to self, bring a scientist to the next Food Friday. I think this is
I've been waiting.
There is a whole branch of chemistry called food science.
Yeah.
You can get a PhD in food science.
We actually have had a food scientist from the Culinary Institute on, and he wears a lab coat to the show. It's very, very strange.
He would be let into the geek party, yes.
Hey, Madeline, thanks for the call. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 as we hit the home stretch on this science forum. Kurt in Leverett, Mass. Kurt, you're on.
Hello, everybody. I walk my dog every day under some high-tension power lines, and I've noticed when it's raining, the wires make a crackling sound. Why is that?
It's probably because it's actually sparking around the insulators.
You smell ozone?
I don't, but even between the towers where there aren't any insulators, it makes kind of a buzzing sound, a buzzing and crackling sound.
Right. So, yeah, little tiny lightning bolts.
Cool.
What's causing that?
Well, it's from the positive to the negative wire effect. What the wires are AC wires. No, excuse me. I believe the high tension lines are DC.
So, wasn't that the whole Tesla Edison battle?
But there's something about 10,000 watt or higher where they actually run DC wires.
And they're arcing from where to where?
And they're arcing from one wire to the other wire. They're actually arcing back and forth between each other.
Through the water vapor.
Right, through the water vapor, which is allowing a certain amount of a dielectric constant or dielectric effect between the wires.
Huh. Now, my next question about those wires is, can a bird land on those wires without any problem?
Yes, because it's not grounded.
It's not grounded.
Although it might make its little feathers kind of rise up from the charging.
I'm sure as it gets close and feels those little lightning bolts, it'll stay away.
And you wouldn't want one to be touching the platform either.
No. There are
I've also noticed when I walk with an umbrella, and if the umbrella touches my head, there's a little shock coming onto my head from the umbrella.
Yeah, it's because the very high voltage is inducing a charge.
Right.
Like static electricity on a balloon.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you wore rubber shoes, it would be okay?
I don't know.
No,
I'll try
because the water would actually act as a conduit between your body and over the rubber into the ground.
Okay. Well, good luck, Kurt. That sounds interesting.
I wouldn't do that.
No? All right. Fair enough. You guys have followed Tesla, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Didn't he have a method of actually sending electricity from point A to point B?
A point of sight?
Yeah.
I think I read about that, but I have never really investigated what it's been.
That may have been by microwaves, because you can transmit energy by microwaves. I mean,
the radio waves.
Yeah.
That's what they are.
Yeah, radio waves and microwaves are about the same energy. Yeah.
I'm glad I brought Tesla up with 7 minutes to go, because we'll have plenty of calls on the next program. Benjamin in Clifton Park. Benjamin, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. All right. I had a question. So let's say you're in space. It's a perfect vacuum. You're away from planets and black holes, and you have an identical twin in front of you. And then you were to punch that identical twin in the face. Would that person receive any damage to their face, or would their entire body just move backwards? And would your body also move backwards? I've never been able to figure it out in college physics for the
deep
MCAT.
Thoughts.
And I just see it as two bowling balls and equally flying backwards.
Yeah, but we're not bowling balls.
Can you actually injure someone in space?
Yeah. If you do that, it because of the inertia of the mass, you would probably do some damage.
Okay.
But then you would fly away from each other, so you wouldn't be able to get revenge.
Only one twin would have the black eye.
Only one twin could hit at a time. But yes, because of the inertia, there would be a smack, probably less than you would get, more or less
stationary.
So
if it was Mike Tyson, it might still hurt.
Yes.
Okay.
It would have to do too, with the speed of the punch or the slap.
Let's say there's no friction. You're in a perfect vacuum.
But you're still compressing tissue.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing, and that's where the damage goes. And again, back to those cells. You're breaking those cells. Those cells will cause bruising.
Yeah, but so, I mean, I don't know, maybe the intramolecular bonds stretch a little, but...
Oh, it's a much larger force than that.
There's no friction.
If you'd like to try it with me sometime, we could do it.
Yeah, let's figure it out.
No, it's a matter, though, that you're thinking that as soon as some force is applied, the other body will just fly away. It doesn't work that way because there's inertia to be overcome.
Right.
And because of the mass of that body, that force has to accelerate it more or less slowly. And it's in that process of transferring the energy, of accelerating that other person, that that the force gets applied and you would cause the damage.
Benjamin, do you get out much?
What's up?
Do you get out much? That's a deep question. You must have had a lot of time to think about it.
Well, if you
I'm still not convinced, because even if there's inertia, there's nothing to resist it in the perfect vacuum.
Think about this.
It doesn't need a vacuum.
Imagine if the other person is moving at the same speed as your fist. Okay?
Right.
So you're hitting the person and he's moving at the same speed as the fist, then the fist would have almost no effect on the person. The inertia is the fact that the other person has to get to speed in order for the fist not to have an effect.
So he's motionless when he's first hit.
Right, and therefore there's an opposite and equal reaction even though you're in a frictionless environment.
Right, but I mean, can't the inertia just be transferred from me
it is.
The other person?
It's being transferred. That's what causes the person to move.
But if there's no friction, then that inertia just continues. I don't know.
Friction. No, it's not the friction. It's a matter of having to accelerate that mass. So a force has to be applied to accelerate that mass.
Wow.
And that force would cause damage.
Right.
Great question, Benjamin. Thank you very much for that. Do you remember a science forum with this many interesting questions?
These are questions that have been saved up since 2014. I mean,
they're saving the best.
Well, maybe in 2017 we'll have another good one. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Michael in Wallkill. Michael, you're on.
Hey, Happy New Year tomorrow.
Thanks.
I guess I got a question about some gravity and light, and all our readings have been taken for the speed of light under the influence of our sun. So how do we know that what we use as the speed of light is actually accurate?
That's a great question.
It can change, can't it?
Well, we've talked about it quite a bit here about the uncertainty in the speed of light, or the variability perhaps of speed of light, and how do we know? So,
well, I can tell you that the first time the speed of light was ever tested, and this is one of the ways you can check this, is that we know, for example, when the moons of Jupiter go behind Jupiter. And what happens is we know exactly what time that is because we know how fast the moons of Jupiter go around. And the further Jupiter is away from us, the more offset there is between the time that the moon goes behind Jupiter and the time we think it's going to happen. So we can actually measure the speed of light through space going from the moons, for example.
But
it was one of the first tests.
Right, but his point is true. That's under the influence of our sun.
Yes, but you can do it, for example, on either side of the sun to see what the influence of the sun is.
That's true.
And there is a change, and that's because space-time is curved, because the sun is there.
And there's always an influence of gravity of some sort, because you can't escape gravity in the universe.
Right, and that's why space-time is curved.
Michael, thanks a lot. I guess we're just about out of time here. Can we handle Doug? Doug, you have about 10 seconds. Quick question, quick answer, okay?
Yes. How is it that we can see Venus in the night sky if it's within the Earth, if it's closer to the sun than the Earth?
Okay.
If it's in front of the sun, you can't see it. It has to be light coming from the sun to the side, just like the moon. So even though when the moon is to the side of us, we can see it. When the moon's in front of the sun, it's a new moon and you can't see it.
Okay, I guess we'll have to leave it there. Doug and Newberg, you're the last one today, the last one of the year here on Vox Pop.
Woo.
We are just about out of time. Thanks to everybody who called in today. Sorry, actually, we left no one on the line. This was a very efficient program. And thanks to Ed Stander and Barbara Rabbits and Jim Pickett for being here. Thanks to everybody for listening all year long on Vox Pop. Have a lovely new year. Support comes from Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in...
right. Celebrate your new year with a divorce. Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in divorce mediation and collaborative divorce, helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce. Offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. UpstateDivorceMediation.com. And maybe Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, New York, presenting the Let's Eat exhibit and lecture series exploring food, culture, technology, and history on view now, SchenectadyHistorical.org. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for all the great calls. Great show today. We appreciate it. And thanks to Zachary Malloy, who all year long has done a great job with a couple of exceptions. Well done, Zach. And Paulette Ryder took your calls today. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein, Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. No show tomorrow. Have a great New Year's Eve. Do not drink and drive. We'll see you next year.